prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. My co-host, Alfred Adisk, will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report for the final two segments of the hour today, which was recorded last evening. So, for the next 20 minutes, you will hear my opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for October 23rd, 2014. A little bit of an odd day this week. There was just so many predictions coming out last week with the markets dropping and what this week held for the markets, anywhere from all these big dollar analysts saying that the USDX was going to drop significantly and, gold was going to go up 300 points this week. And I mean, just all these bizarre opinions and predictions for the markets, and any time you have rigged markets, it's very difficult to follow any type of chart in order to help make your predictions. And we're going to be talking about the Hunt brothers and silver here in a little bit, and one of the brothers just recently died this week of the Hunt brothers. We'll be talking about them and their little escapade in their silver in 79 and 80, 1979 and 1980. But first, let's go to the market report today. We have gold down $8.50 today. At $1,233, we have silver up 4 cents at $1,732. Platinum was down 4 at $1,260, and palladium was up 14 at $784. That was up almost 2% on the day. The USDX today was up 0.11 at $85.85. Crude oil. Let me get to my regular paper markets today to see what the contracts did in oil today. 82.04 down 0.05, 82.04. The Dow was up 216 points at 16,677, and that was closer to 300 earlier in the day, so it didn't recover almost 100 points. The NASDAQ was up 70 points at 44.52, and the S&P was up 23 at 19.50, and the 10-year yield up 0.05 at 2.28%. So it was a good day. You know, of course, they're bragging about all the corporate earnings, and most of those big corporate earnings, you had Caterpillar. That's a Dow stock. They were up. And even though they talk about with oil prices being down, it shows a lack of demand around the world. They're still estimating next year's earnings to be higher than what they were this year. So, and you know, what else are they going to say? You know, people think this is a great thing that they're going to do any better. What else are they going to say? Oh no, you know, we're going to be down significantly next year. Of course not. So, you know, don't buy into all their glory reports on what is going to be happening. So I had a couple of calls on this. It's the Swiss gold referendum. Everybody's talking about it. They're talking about the impact it could have on the price of gold. And the way I view this is the impact, it's going to be a bonus to gold, of course, if it gets passed. It's going to bring a lot of tension to gold. It's going to bring a lot of tension to central banks in gold. It's going to bring a lot of tension to the people's belief in gold. And a lot of the other people think that because of this, and we'll go a little bit more into detail about the price of gold, would rise significantly. I believe the price of gold is going to rise significantly just on the fundamentals alone. There was a poll taken. And there's a slim majority of Swiss citizens that said that they would vote in favor of this referendum to force the Swiss National Bank to increase and hold on to their gold reserves. And they also want to take physical delivery and keep the gold in their country. This is the first opinion poll regarding this referendum. And this poll was on Tuesdays from the Switzerland's biggest daily newspaper. They did release the results, and it was an online survey. And according to the poll, which was conducted on October 15th, it had about 13,000 respondents. 45% to 39% said they would support the Save Our Gold initiative. The report also shows that there's a high number of undecided voters. So, you know, this might be another Scotland where, you know, you have a lot of people who want it, but it's not going to get through. You have a bunch of undecided voters who really don't really voice their opinions until they actually go to the polls. Well, this is supposed to be November 30th, I believe, is the date the citizens will go to the polls to vote on the three areas. And these are the three areas that I had mentioned previously about should the Swiss National Bank increase its gold reserves to 20%. That the central bank should stop selling its precious metals, and that all its gold should be held within the country. Now that, and although Switzerland's first opinion poll was positive, there's some analysts that are hesitant to declare it a victory for the yes side. And I guess that the vote is November 30th. The online polling methods, it was not a pre-selected panel. It may introduce biases into the results, but it was a fairly large sample size and certainly a good representative of demographics for this poll. And this was confirmed by the political scientists at the University College of London and, of course, the University of Zurich suggests that the poll cannot be dismissed. Barclays added that even if the referendum does win the popular vote, the initiative still has to be passed by the majority of 26 Swiss cantons, the different regions in Switzerland. The analyst says because of the government's and central bank's opposition to the gold initiative, it would be unlikely to break this insurmountable barrier, meaning it doesn't really matter what the vote is going to be. When you have the central bank ruling and you have the government's ruling and they're in opposition to this initiative, hey, we get it here. We understand. We understand what happens. Government doesn't like gold and silver. Government doesn't like, or the Federal Reserve doesn't like gold or silver. So they do have a difficult battle. And the government and the Swiss National Bank have been urging people to vote against the referendum, saying that it would impede the central bank's monetary policy. You don't want to mess with their monetary policy. And so it would be a good thing for the people, a bad thing for the central banks. According to the World Gold Council, Switzerland holds about a little over 1,000 metric tons of gold, about 7.8% of it, foreign reserves. And if this was passed, they would have to purchase about 1,500 tons of gold over the next 5 years. And a currency analyst added that it would cost the central bank between $67 and $83 billion. So that's a lot of money going into gold and 1,500 tons over the and within a five-year period. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see exactly what impact it would have on the price of gold. So we'll have to wait and see, and let's hope those citizens and all the votes that it does get passed. But again, not so sure it will, but at least the thought is there. I had mentioned we were going to talk about Nelson Bunker. He was one of the Hunt brothers. He died at 88. And this article was kind of interesting because it looked back at the various traders at that point in time, 79 and 80, when the bunkers, when the Hunt brothers were doing this, when they tried to corner the silver market between 1979. And he was in Dallas. I'll have to ask Al if he knew him. But he had died of Alzheimer's disease. The Hunt family initially made their money in oil, and I know many of you might know this story already, but it's interesting. It's interesting to look at those times, how things worked and how all the regulation has changed and the commodities exchanges that were up and operating that have closed and how it's been so consolidated and how everybody, it was so done manually. I mean, it is kind of interesting, and this is why I'd like to share it with you. You have to remember that they tried to corner the silver market, and they pushed prices up from $6 an ounce to over $48 before. We can't have that happen. So the COMEX comes in and they change the rules. Hey, let's just change the rules in the middle of these people making money. We'll change the rules on leverage and put heavy restrictions on commodities bought on margin. And of course, that made the Hunt brothers lose over $1 billion in the incident. In 1985, the CFTC accused the Hunt brothers, along with others, of illegally manipulating silver prices during 1979 and 1980. Now we just about have everybody coming out saying that the gold market is rigged. Now the silver market is rigged. You have various banks around the world that are being accused of rigging the markets, of manipulating the markets. And what is being done? Absolutely nothing. But then again, maybe this was the test of all time. The Hunt brothers denied any wrongdoing, and in 1989 they agreed to pay up to $10 million in penalties and accept a ban from trading commodities. George Giro, vice president with RBC Capital Markets Global Futures, was a floor broker at the time in the COMEX. He says it was interesting because whenever they saw brokers from Conti Commodities, and this was the company that handled the Hunt brothers' trading, he said the silver price would go up a few pennies. He says just as they were coming into the ring, it would go up just a few pennies, even before they started buying. He says it wasn't unusual to see market participants pay attention when big traders come to the floor. But when they came in, it was different. He says in Chicago, what happened, you would wait to see somebody like Richard Dennis to see if he's going to start buying or selling. You don't start buying if you saw him coming toward the ring. He says that was the major difference. What if he comes in to be a seller? He says, but when we knew this Conti Commodities would come in, they were always buying. And, of course, the Hunt brothers were buying enough to support prices and change the outlook on the markets. He says what happened was as technical charts, and this is what we don't have today, because you cannot have true technical charts when markets are rigged. He says, but then when those charts changed and started to look fantastic, other people got into it too. The technical chartists, momentum players, And this was the time when charts meant something. But then silver put in that long base and everybody went, holy mackerel. And, based on those charts and based on that momentum, it wouldn't have mattered what the product was because the momentum was so strong and because the charts looked good. And this is why all these analysts get all these numbers wrong so many times, because they don't include the equation of markets being rigged. If they applied that to the charts, they'd have a little bit better history when it comes to numbers. They said when they were in the markets, they never felt they were cornering the market. They actually thought that the world was buying, that this was an international thing going on. The Swiss was buying, the commodity people were buying, and they thought something was going on in the world. And I remember back in 79 and 80, we didn't have the communication as we do today. The market was getting incorrect signals, especially when they found that one of the problems, the reasons for the spike up, was lack of deliverable supply. So, again, now we look at then, we look at today's, we talk about the lack of product, the lack of the inability to deliver in the COMEX. And, of course, this was the same problem they had then. And the lack of supply was apparent, but it didn't bring the house down. So when you hear the same people talk about the lack of supply in these markets, in the COMEX markets, personally, it's the physical delivery of paper. It's the physical delivery that's really going to make the prices skyrocket. The inability to buy on a physical delivery basis. And then we're talking about the old days. You could trade all these markets. You could trade Chicago, New York, London, Paris. I bet it was really exciting in the momentum and the excitement. I can remember in 2008 when prices of gold was rising and $20 gold prices, they were going up $300 and $400 moves when we were only getting like a $80 move in gold. I mean, it was exciting. I mean, I'd be putting people on hold to get the current price. And by the time I got back to the phone, prices were up $20, $30, $40, just a matter of seconds. So it does get very exciting. That's what moves these markets. That's when you're going to see, $200 and $300 moves in the price of gold. But it's interesting because there are so often their trading is looked back on, and to see the price of silver move to that degree, we were able to experience it once again a few short years ago. And I do believe you will be able to experience it once more. And I believe the next difference when we begin to see gold when we begin to see silver move upward to that $50 level, I don't think you're going to see the crash happen like we saw before. I think once this momentum begins, because I think our country, the financial system, is poised in a different place as it was in 2008. And I think once it begins to unfold and we begin to see the prices increase, there's going to be so much, fuel behind it that I don't believe you're going to see these big corrections that we've seen before. And this is, we talk about things happening around the world. This time there is something happening around the world. I looked at the European markets. Their markets came back a little bit overnight. They're certainly having difficulty. And the whole world, the whole system is being propped up on stimulus coming from central banks. And once that stimulus ends, you will begin to see things unfold. One thing we're going to see things unfold is the last 20 or the first 20 minutes of the program. We're just about ready to go into break here. And I want to thank each and every one of you for joining me these first 20 minutes. And I heard it was a great interview last night with Alfred and James Corbett. So enjoy. We'll be right back.
pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Are you concerned about prescription drug dependency to stay healthy? Are you worried that the cost and availability of your medications may put your health at risk? Perhaps it's time you consider a natural, safe, and effective way to deal with your health problems. If only you knew where to start. Start right here. Tune in to Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETT REPORT.com, CorbettReport.com. James is living in Japan. He's been there for 10 years. He's an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, and you catch him on video and articles, and quite prolific and always a little bit amazing to talk to, because he doesn't seem to get, he doesn't have brain lock. You know, I get to talking sometimes, and you just draw a blank. You know, you think you're sounding intelligent or whatever, and all of a sudden, James doesn't seem to have that problem. I have no idea why exactly, but he doesn't seem to have moments of brain lock. Is that true, James? Hello, James?
Oh, sorry about that. Yes, I'm here. Yes, it is usually true, but it is probably not true today. You have me at a disadvantage because I was up until 4:30 in the morning today as I was recording a spot on Abby Martin's Breaking the Set on RT. So I am absolutely tired out today, and we'll see if I'm able to speak without brain lock.
Well, I understand. You put together a little podcast recently on how to herd your techs. Animals, if I remember the title correctly. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yes, how to herd your tax cattle.
That's it.
Yeah, it was a particularly popular podcast episode that I have. I do a podcast on a regular basis, at least a couple of times a month. It used to be every week, but I couldn't keep up that production schedule. But I do a podcast on CorbettReport.com a couple times a month. And this particular podcast episode, basically, instead of just delivering a straightforward episode, I decided to deliver it in the form of a briefing from an imaginary briefer to a newly elected president of some unnamed country, but presumably the United States. And the briefer is part of the shadow government that helped to get the president elected, i.e. the power behind the throne, the people who are really pulling the strings. And so it's all about the psychology of control and the various documented real experiments and other things that have shown over the years the ways that psychological control mechanisms are wielded over the public by the power elite, the ruling elite, whatever you want to call them, the people who are in positions of power to manipulate the public. And it sometimes can be ridiculously, deceptively simple. In fact, there are experiments that have shown time and again in various different experimental settings that simply dressing someone in a uniform that looks official, even if it's a completely made-up uniform and doesn't actually denote any sort of actual power or authority, can make people comply with the uniformed individual's demands as much as 70% of the time, no matter how ridiculous some of the demands are. And I show a clip in that video, for example, of an example of that happening just outside of a shopping mall in London, where some experimenters put someone in a really official looking uniform and got them to do basically anything he said, switch their shopping bags to the opposite hand, hop on one foot. I mean, all sorts of ridiculous things. And that people would simply comply because the person was dressed in a uniform and looked official. And that is, again, a remarkably simple part of the overall control grid, but a remarkably effective one. So that episode was basically just going through some of those psychological control mechanisms and how they basically get us to comply with things that if we were to stop and think about it, we probably would not. So it's a fascinating topic, and so much research has gone into it over the decades that it was actually not very difficult to find a number of examples of those types of experiments that that have been demonstrated the various psychological control mechanisms in the past.
Do you think that's good news, bad news, or is it just the state of humanity? I mean, has it always been that way?
Yeah,
if we went back 1,000 years ago, if you put on a uniform, you could get the people to comply. 3,000, 5,000. Is it part of human nature, or is it a sign that something's happening that's not a good thing?
Well, I don't think the uniform example is necessarily part of human nature, because obviously that's culturally dependent, and we've been trained all our lives that people in uniforms who are wielding authority are people whose authority should be respected. And obviously we understand there are consequences to that because we equate it with police officers or what have you, people who can lawfully detain us. So I think a lot of that is cultural conditioning and education, but there are other parts of this, these experiments that show, I think, a deeper psychological makeup of humans that I think is part of what it means to be human. And you can look, for example, at the Milgram experiment, I think a pretty famous example. I'm sure a lot of your audience will have heard of this by this point. Basically, the idea is that the experimenters are conducting an experiment in which they conduct some people, bring some people into the experiment who believe that they're doing a study on improving people's learning abilities, or at least testing people's learning abilities and testing negative reinforcement to see if they can make people learn at a faster rate. So the idea is there's a learner who has to memorize a bunch of paired words, and if they fail to memorize and give the correct paired word for each word in this list, then an electric shock has to be administered to this other person. And so this the person who's being experimented on is the one who's delivering these electric shocks. Now they don't know.
Now he doesn't think he thinks he's part of the experiment, but he doesn't think he's the subject of the experiment.
Exactly right.
He thinks he's one of the employees that's experimenting on the other guy who's allegedly getting the shock.
Exactly right. And of course, it is a fake shock, and it is an actor who's portraying the person who's being shocked. So none of that is really real, but the person believes it is real, and he believes he is delivering actual electric shocks to this learner. And the experiment shows, and it was interesting. I mean, it's not just one experiment that was run once. It was run multiple times in different settings, because even the experimenter, Stanley Milgram, couldn't believe, really, the results that he was getting. Most psychologists, when asked before seeing the results of this experiment, how many people would go up to 450 volts, potentially lethal levels of electric shock, the psychologist responded probably 1% of people would go that high. As it turned out, I can't remember the actual figure, but it was much higher than that. I believe 2/3 of people would go as high as delivering the 450 volt, the full electric shock. So it was quite shocking at the time. And it was, again, not just once. It was done multiple times in different settings because they thought, oh, this is being conducted at, not Yale. I can't remember. Stanford. Was it Stanford? Was it Yale?
No,
it was a prestigious Ivy League university anyway.
Yeah.
So they thought, well, why don't we do it in a different location? We'll do it somewhere downtown and in a dungy old building so it doesn't look, so people aren't so intimidated by these men in white coats who are telling them what to do. And all of these different settings they tried in different ways. And time and again, they found that the majority of people would deliver lethal levels of electric shock. But the interesting part of that experiment, and something that a lot of people don't know about or talk about, is that the experiments also found that they could actually, basically the experimenters found they could adjust the level of people who would be willing to deliver those lethal levels of electric shock up or down by changing the sort of settings of the environment. So, for example, if you see someone ahead of you doing this experiment and they deliver lethal levels of electric shock, you are more likely to deliver levels of lethal electric shock. But if you see someone ahead of you refusing to deliver those lethal levels of electric shock, you are more likely to refuse to deliver lethal levels of electric shock. And in fact, there was one implementation of the experiment where they could get 100% of people to refuse to go ahead with it. And that was in the case where the learner said they actually wanted to be shocked. And so the people delivering the experiment would actually refuse to shock them because they thought that was perverse.
Yeah, what does a real sadist do to a real masochist? Nothing.
yeah, that's a good point. Very interesting.
It makes you wonder, were they wrong to hang Adolf Eichmann when he said he was just following orders? Because what you're suggesting here, I mean, it's not just an irrational defense. It's not just an excuse. Eichmann's defense describes something that is found in human nature. People will just follow orders right up to administering near lethal shocks of electricity.
And simply because an authority figure tells them to do so. That's a key part of the experiment. The authority figure, the person running the experiment, will tell the person delivering the shocks, oh, it's okay, I'll take responsibility, go ahead. And just with those words, people will more often than not go ahead and continue raising the shock level. So that's, I mean, it's an interesting study about power and authority and how that can make people do things that they would otherwise not want to do. But I think the key part of that is if people see other people resisting, they themselves will resist, more likely.
I understand that. And there's a classic illustration of that. Back during the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a moment when there was a ruling cadre of bureaucrats, perhaps 9, 10, I don't remember how many were there, but they ordered a Russian Spetsnaz colonel who was famous within Russia. I mean, this guy was the real deal, and Spetsnaz being their special forces, essentially, similar to our special forces. This guy was a national hero. They ordered him to go off and kill Boris Yeltsin, to assassinate Yeltsin. And the colonel said, no, I won't do it. And then they ordered the next guy, who was next to him, to go do this. The next guy refused, and so on down the line. And as a result, nobody shot Boris Yeltsin. And the lesson here was because one man who had been just following orders, he had been absolutely, you know, faithful, fearless, loyal to the whoever was running the country. They said, go, he went. You know, he said, no, he wouldn't do it. And in a sense, that one man may have changed history. Just by him standing up, then the next colonel or captain or whoever was there, they said, no, I won't do it either. And on down the line, and Boris Yeltsin was therefore not assassinated.
It's exactly right. It's such an important example of that phenomenon. And I think the really bigger picture of this is that, yes, there have been attempts to understand psychological motivations of human beings that go back, I mean, decades, centuries, really. I mean, the human animal is the most studied animal on the planet by far because of the utility of being able to control people's actions in one way or another. So obviously, this psychology of control has been refined over the decades. But I think the point is that just as there is a psychology of control, I think there is also a psychology of resistance. And we should probably be more better informed, I should say, of that. Those techniques that we can use. And that's why things like what you and I are doing and trying to spread some sanity in this world of seeming insanity that we're getting from the corporate controlled media, when you and I are doing this type of media, I think it's an important thing for a lot of people to hear. And it's one of the consistent pieces of feedback I get from people is, I'm so glad to have found a program like this, because I thought I was alone. I thought I was the only one who felt these things, but and the people around me all seem to be listening to the Squawk Box, the television. I'm glad to have found a program like this. And that's why I think it is important for us to show that there are people out there who resist. There are people who don't believe the programming that we're getting. And that social proof, it can be enough to start that chain reaction that, as you say, I mean, it can take is one person standing up to really change the course of history.
Yeah. And when you see that example, you know, this is such strange information, because on the one hand, it's pessimist. It's cause for pessimism. So, oh my gosh, the majority of people will just follow orders. On the other hand, it's kind of cause for optimism by saying, wait a second, if one guy stands up, all of a sudden, other people will say, wait, I think I can stand up too.
I'm sorry.
I hear that example. So,
no, I'm
is the glass half full or half empty?
Yes. Yes, well, it's both. I mean, it's what we make of it, ultimately.
That's
because
exactly
if we
right.
just go, yeah, if we just lie down and go along with whatever's happening, then we will be run over by that steamroller. But if we stand up to it, suddenly we have strength in numbers that we never could have imagined. And it really is, I mean, it truly is, I think, a battle for consciousness, more so than any other single aspect of this. I mean, we can look at the economic and the geopolitical and the financial and the other aspects of the control grid, but ultimately it's psychological in nature. And the first thing that we have to do is stand up to what's happening. It's kind of like that rant by Howard Beale in Network. You know, the first
I'm
part is you have
hell.
To get angry.
Yeah.
Just get mad.
I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things you also see. I think first time I've seen this was from Alex Jones on his programs, InfoWars and so on. And he talks about resistance is victory. Just resisting, recognizing you can resist. You don't have to get out there and throw a bomb. All you got to do is say, nope, I'm not going to cooperate with this. It is a kind of victory to just resist. We used to have meetings in Dallas for what became the single largest legal reform meeting in the country back at the time. This is back in the 1990s. And one of the things I noticed is this was for people who had been just beaten up and virtually destroyed by the legal system, and either in divorce or IRS or traffic courts or whatever. They were wounded in the way they thought about themselves and they thought about life, and they thought they were all alone. And I started the same way. I went through a divorce and it got me up. What I saw is that people came to the meetings, and when they found out they weren't alone, it was just a tremendously empowering moment. They think, wait a second, I'm not crazy. I'm not the bad guy. I'm not the nutcase in this thing. My God, there's other people who understand what I'm talking about. And in that, they found great, you know, empowerment and optimism. And you know, it was Citizens for Legal Reform was the name of the group. But in fact, it was, you'd think we were dealing with politics and legal issues. It was in many regards kind of a group therapy session. You bring people in and teach them. You're not alone. That means you're not wrong, all right? There's validity the way you think. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
James Corbett from the Corbett Report. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, of course, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. We've been talking about some of the ideas that are in one of James's most recent podcasts, where he talks he's giving insight into how the government can herd its tax cattle. How do folks find a copy of that podcast, James?
Just type how to herd your tax cattle into the YouTube search engine. They'll find my YouTube video version, or, of course, they can just go to CorbettReport.com, and it's in the podcast section. In fact, I think it's still on the front page of CorbettReport.com right now near the bottom.
I did a program earlier with Melody, and we're talking about something that's close to the concept of the psychological control of people, manipulation of markets. What's the real price of crude oil? What's the real price of gold? Is the Dow Jones, does it reflect a rational understanding of what the value of the market or equities should be at this point in time? And the idea it's parallels the idea of voting machines being tampered with, where even elections may be influenced or controlled in a way that we don't clearly understand and can't prove. And what I was complaining about earlier today was the idea that all of this manipulation by the powers that be for the purpose of controlling us and making us think we're living in a decent circumstance and maybe make us think we should be happy, it deprives us of access to reality. And I find that disturbing, right? I don't even care if they're pretty lies. I don't want people telling me any more lies. I'd like to get into the real world and not be protected from it by government manipulation and control. And supposedly they're making me a happier person with this manipulation. Do you see what I'm saying, that we're being deprived of? When you're deprived of truth, you're deprived of reality, you're isolated, insulated, separated. Do you find that disturbing, or do you even notice it? Do you notice what I'm talking about? Is that something you see or
I certainly do, and I think perhaps the primary metaphor or example of that in our modern era was encapsulated in the Matrix series, which it's kind of the touchstone for this this discourse, isn't it? Where back, of course, in 1999, the Wachowski brothers released the first Matrix movie, which provides, I think, a very clear example of what a lot of the alternative media talks about, which is why so much of our vocabulary sources from that movie, which is an interesting phenomenon in itself. But yes, it's this idea that there is this constructed, this reality constructed around us. And it's interesting when what's his name, Morpheus, is telling Neo about the Matrix and the examples that he's using in that speech. He's saying it's there when you pay your taxes and other such things, which I think are really tips of the hat towards this idea, this understanding that all of this, these various systems of governmental control that have been woven around us, are this type of matrix that obviously is just a metaphor for the type of constructed reality that we're living in. So I certainly do understand what you're saying, and I think that the experience that I know I had, and I have no doubt many other people had, when they first started really encountering some of this alternative information, was that experience of being suddenly thrust into a different world. It was like waking up, which is often the metaphor that's used. It was like waking up into a reality that I hadn't seen before, and suddenly everything was subtly different, but it made sense. It made more sense when you start to peel back the layers of lies. And I think it goes back to the age-old philosophical question, are you happier living in that matrix? Even if you knew it was a matrix, would you be happier eating the matrix steak, as one of the characters in that yep. movie talks about? You yep. know, I know this isn't a real steak. I know it's just neurons firing in my brain that is telling me that I'm eating a steak, but I don't care. It tastes just as good, and I love the experience, so I'm going to enjoy this. And that's really the question. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people would answer that they would prefer the lies. And that is, again, a fundamental part of human psychology, that a lot of people would prefer to hear sweet lies rather than hard truths. And because of that, they can be easily led. And that's another aspect of the control grid. We often think of this as being some sort of top-down hierarchical thing where there's, you know, people trying to manipulate us. But in some ways, it's the example of an experiment which I'm pretty sure was never actually conducted, but it's often talked about as a thought experiment, where you have a bunch of monkeys in a room, and there's a banana at the top of a ladder. And any time any one of the monkeys tries to climb the ladder, you spray them with a fire hose to get them off the ladder. So eventually the monkeys know not to try to climb the ladder to get the banana. You remove some of the monkeys from that room and put some in that haven't been trained. They go up to try to get the banana, and they get fire hosed. Eventually, you replace all of the monkeys with new monkeys who were never trained but with the fire hose, and they start they continue the practice of trying to keep the monkeys away from the ladder. Basically, the monkeys are policing themselves. And I think that, yeah, I think that's another example of what happens, is that people prefer the sweet lies to the hard truths so much that they almost want to try to stop people from telling them truths or even looking for truths, which is why the idea of conspiracy theorist is that slur that's supposed to stop us from thinking critically about what the information we're receiving is so effective. It's because other people will police us even more strictly than the system will police us more often than not.
There's an element of consent in this. When we talk about being manipulated and we talk about being controlled or even oppressed, the implication of all of this is all of the problems that we see that are negative are to some extent a reflection of our own willingness to be controlled, manipulated. They need our consent. Right? They don't just push us around because they don't have enough people to do it. This whole system, this matrix, we're in on it. We're part of it. We and if we don't consent, if we withdraw our consent, the system starts to collapse.
I couldn't agree more with that. That's such an important point that is absolutely at the base of everything I do, because it really is the case that, as we were talking about before, when people start standing up, it is a domino effect. When people start resisting, that resistance itself is a victory. It does have fruitful consequences. And if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I wouldn't be doing this website. absolutely is the case that what we need to do is start withdrawing ourselves from the system. Because if the image of the control system is a pyramid, then the very few at the very top are obviously the elite who are running the system, but that system is supported by the masses of people at the bottom of that pyramid who are literally holding the rest of the system up. And that's a perfect metaphor, for example, for the monetary system, the way that that the banks create the money as debt that is owed back to the banks with interest. But who is paying that debt? It's the people. And who is creating that debt? It's the people. And how are they paying that debt back? It's with their blood, sweat, and tears. We are putting ourselves into a form of indentured servitude for years or decades of our lives, when you're talking about car loans or mortgages, mm-hmm. to banks that are creating money out of nothing, all because we basically support that system. We are letting the banks become the middlemen in that system, and we are the base of that financial pyramid. What we need to do is start removing ourselves from the base, and there are so many different ways we can do that in all different aspects. If you want to talk about the monetary aspect, then it's when looking at alternative or complementary types of currencies or ways of transacting with people that don't rely on these Federal Reserve notes. So local exchange trading systems or cryptocurrencies or precious metals or all of the other things that we can do to stop using these Federal Reserve notes, these debt-based instruments that are putting us in indentured servitude to the banks. And again, it is so much a system that relies on our participation that sometimes we kind of have to pinch ourselves and realize that it is absolutely something that we have in our power to start withdrawing ourselves from that system. And even that act of starting to withdraw ourselves from the system, it spurs other people to start withdrawing from the system, and it really quickens the pace of that. So I think that's the real secret to this, that I think the people in that top of the pyramid are very, very concerned about. And that's why you have, for example, Zbigniew Brzezinski in recent years, the perennial insider at the top of the U.S. Pyramid, talking in recent years about the global political awakening and how basically it used to be easier to control a million people than kill a million people. But now with this global political awakening, it's becoming the other way around. It would be easier to kill a million people than control them. And that's scary. That's obviously scary when people in positions of power start talking about things like that. But at any rate, it shows that they are concerned about simply awareness, simply people becoming aware and taking agency back into their own hands. So it is so important that we understand that, internalize it, and start applying it to our lives in order to really overcome this system.
When you talk about the elite at the top of this control pyramid, who are we talking about primarily? I don't believe there's any one answer to this question, but are we talking about government? Are we talking about corporations? Are we talking about intellectuals or Jesuits or the Jewish cabal or whatever? Who is up at the top running this thing? Or is it just kind of a conglomerate?
I would say conglomerate, and I would say it's not necessarily any particular groups so much as it is individuals who have a shared interest in maintaining and perpetuating the power disparity between the top and bottom of the pyramid. And that can be a wide-ranging group. It's an amorphous and ever-changing group, I think. There's backstabbing and things that go on at the upper echelons, I'm sure. So I don't think it's necessarily pinnable, downable to any particular identifiable individuals. But
you must have gone to the same school as George W. Bush. I see that you also create words.
I'm a wordsmith at heart, but hopefully yeah. Better than George Bush. I like pinnable, downable. But to me, the point is that it's very easy to get caught up in the let's identify, you know, the person or the thing at the top of the pyramid, and if we get rid of them, then everything will be better again. But to me, that's a really, really naive way of looking at it, and it's one that's fostered and inculcated us in us through this Hollywood predictive programming and other things, where it's, you know, the Rambo will come along and kill the person at the top and everything will be better again. Mm-hmm. I don't think it works like that, because that just creates a power vacuum, and there are more than enough people who are willing to step into those positions of power. I think, again, the real solution to this isn't at trying to strike to cut off the head of the beast because it's a multi-headed hydra that can regrow its heads. The point is to go for the heart, and we are the heart of the beast system. We are the capillaries and the veins that pump the blood around this system through our participation in it. Remove ourselves from the participation of that system, and we kill the beast. It doesn't even matter at that point where the heads are, who the heads are, or you know what we can do to chop this or that head off. The entire point of this is to withdraw ourselves from it and to start our own system outside of this beast system. And that's, I mean, it's a really difficult thing to do. It's a tall order. I'm not sure it can ever be done 100%. I'm not thinking there's going to be an end to history where we all sit, sing and kumbaya and hold hands. But at any rate, we can be closer to where we want to be than we are today. And again, that's what motivates and drives me.
I think if you had to look, we are inclined to see someone in control at the top, all right? We think that way. That's a natural way of thinking. But I suspect that if we knocked off the top 10%, we would find another right among us. We would find somebody else to fill that role. And it's a function of the values that our particular society and economy has come to assume. We take certain values for granted, and I think the consequences, the logical consequences of many of our values simply create that pyramid. And that somebody's going to sit at the top just because of the logic of things like fiat currency. It pushes people. You're going to accept a fiat currency? That system of values is going to cause us logically to gravitate toward the top of the pyramid, and we're going to be right back where we are. If we want to get away from the pyramid or at least diminish its power, we're going to have to look at values and try to say, what is the fundamental value that we should, you know, walk away from? Where should we go in terms of values? Does that make any sense to you?
100% agreed. It is about our psychology. It's about what we're willing to do to help each other. It's about what we're fighting for at the end of the day, because we have to be fighting for something, not just against something. And I'm fighting for the life that I live, that I love with my family and being outdoors in the fresh air and enjoying this world. I really enjoy my life. That is what I fight for. I love this world. I love other human beings, and that's what I want. And that's why it really disturbs me when I see in the alternative media people talking about the stupid sheep believing the government and they deserve what they get and things like that. Those are the people who would move into positions of power in a
heartbeat if they were empty.
That's exactly what scares me.
We're dealing with a problem here, and the problem, you know, it's the pogo thing. We have met the enemy, and they are us. Mm. We're out of time, James. I want to thank you for being on the program. This is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETT.com, CorbettReport.com. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Be back manana. In the meantime, good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd go around and have a ball. Money, money.